Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Autism Empowerment Radio, your source for acceptance, enrichment, inspiration, and empowerment within the autism and Asperger's communities. Our show will be starting shortly. To listen to archives of previous broadcasts, visit www.autismempowerment.org and click the Autism Empowerment Radio tab. As a nonprofit charity, we rely on public generosity to fund our programs, special events, and support services. Thank you for considering a tax-deductible donation today. Our show is now beginning.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Autism Empowerment Radio. My name is Karen Krecha, and I'm the Executive Director for Autism Empowerment, a nonprofit 501c3 charity dedicated to providing acceptance, enrichment, inspiration, and empowerment for individuals and families of all ages and abilities within the autism and Asperger communities. We were founded in June 2011 in Vancouver, Washington, and are a young and vibrant organization aiming to serve locally, regionally, nationally, and worldwide. Autism Empowerment Radio and our sister station, Autism and Scouting Radio, are just two of the many free programs and services that Autism Empowerment offers and has in development. Our reception since radio launch about 6 months ago has been very positive, and we've been able to bring guests on air talking about a variety of subjects relevant and interesting to those on the autism spectrum, as well as the families, caregivers, teachers, and professionals who support them. As we are a public charity, our ability to expand and enhance our program offerings depends on public support. In this time of giving, we ask that you consider a gift to Autism Empowerment. Donations of any size are welcome, and you can get details on our website at www.autismempowerment.org. Thank you so much. Those of you who know me realize that asking for money is not something that I'm innately prone to do, but this isn't for me. This is for our autism and Asperger community. So I thank you again for your consideration and generous support. Well, today, if you're listening in live, our original broadcast date is Wednesday, December 19th, 2012. Because of the subject nature of today's show, I believe we may have a lot of listeners tuning in with us for the first time. So for those listeners, we welcome you to Autism Empowerment Radio, and if you happen to be a returning guest, welcome back. All shows that we offer on Autism Empowerment Radio are available to listen to for free at blogtalkradio.com/autismempowerment. You can also download our shows to your computer, iPhone, iPad, or favorite mobile device by subscribing for free to our podcast station directly at iTunes. And if you want to find that, all you have to do is go to your favorite search engine or go to Google and type in Autism Empowerment iTunes or Autism Scouting iTunes if you're looking for our sister station, and that'll quickly take you to where you can see all our previous broadcasts and get a free subscription. We'd really like to stay connected with you after the broadcast, and if you're Facebook or social media savvy, we invite you to connect with us at our Facebook page, facebook.com, Autism Empowerment, and you can find our Facebook and Twitter links directly on our autismempowerment.org website. Today's interview is going to be starting very shortly. I'm bringing in Carla Helbert from www.carlahelbert.com on air, and we will be talking about her recently released book, Finding Your Own Way to Grieve, a creative activity workbook for kids and teens on the autism spectrum. I was asked by a number of listeners in advance if we would be talking at all about the violence and tragedy experienced on December 14th in Newtown, Connecticut. The short answer is yes, we will be talking about it in the context of Carla's book and her training as a licensed professional counselor. However, that's not going to be the main focus of the show. That being said, for those who are interested in that topic, we are hosting a show on Thursday, December 21st at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, called Autism and Asperger's, Making Sense of Violence and Tragedy. That particular show is about helping our autism and Asperger community come together in a positive way in the aftermath of recent events. We invite you to tune into that show as well or catch it later in archives. And then on Friday, December 21st at 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, we figured it was time to add a little levity and happiness and get back into the holiday spirit. So we're going to be talking about holidays with a very spirited, effervescent 6-year-old boy on the autism spectrum. Ryan has been a guest on our show before talking about his Tiger Cub Scout adventures and random things that are just so very amusing. He was very well received. He's very excited to return and share his favorite holiday songs, traditions, and thoughts about giving. So this should be lots of fun. Be sure to check that out on Friday. So back to today's show and our special guest, Carla Helbert. Carla is a licensed professional counselor who has over 16 years of experience in working with people on the autism spectrum, as well as their families. She operates a private psychotherapy practice with a focus on loss, grief, and bereavement, and she specializes in therapy for people with autism spectrum disorders. Carla also facilitates bereavement support groups for local hospices and for the Miss Foundation. As a bereaved mother and a trained therapist, she has a deep personal as well as a clinical understanding of the difficult issues facing those grieving the deaths of loved ones. Her book, Finding Your Own Way to Grieve, a creative activity workbook for kids and teens on the autism spectrum, was released in the USA earlier this fall through Jessica Kingsley Publishers. There's no other book like it in the marketplace, and although it covers a delicate and challenging topic, loss is one area which we all have to deal with. And I find this book to be a compassionate and valuable resource, whether you're helping your child or teen on the autism spectrum, or even whether you're trying to work through your own grief process. So we're going to be talking about that today, and so let's go ahead now and bring Carla on air. Carla, welcome to Autism Empowerment Radio.
Hi, Karen. Thank you so much for having me here today, and thanks for that lovely introduction.
Oh, you're very welcome. You're very, very welcome. Your book is something that has really touched my heart, and I wanted to make sure that our listeners had an opportunity to hear about it. And so I guess my first question for you is, what prompted you to write this book?
Well, as you said, I've been working with kids and teens and adults also on the spectrum for a long time, and this would have been about in 2000. I was working with this kid in a nonprofit. He was a kind of new to our school. I worked as a therapist in a private school, nonprofit school for children and adolescents with developmental disabilities. A lot of them were on the spectrum that were co-occurring with other behavioral issues and different things that were going on. And he was a new student, and both of his grandfathers had recently died. And his parents were concerned, and he was having a very difficult time. And since he was going to be my client and I was his therapist, I was looking for resources to help me work with him, and there were literally there was nothing out there. And so I wrote him a story about death and dying, and When People Die was the name of the story I wrote for him. And it seemed to be helpful, and it allowed us to talk about, you know, other things having to do with his grandfather and find ways, or both of them, find ways to remember them and talk about his feelings or draw his feelings, different activities. And over the years, lots of different people have used that story with their children when people have died on and off the spectrum. And it's been read at memorial services, different places like that. And so that was that, and that was before my son was ever born and before he died. And so then my whole life changed when my son, Theo, was diagnosed as an infant with a very rare brain tumor, and then he died 9 months. He was only 9 months old when he died, and that was in 2006. So my first, the beginnings of this book were written way before my own grief journey began, and a couple years after that, after my son died, I've written a memoir about my journey with him, and I was bringing his book out, working on it, and then the story, When People Die, was in my head, and I was thinking about that and thinking about kids that I work with and knowing there was not a lot out there. Now there is another book that's excellent by Catherine Faherty, and it's different from my book, but it's still, there's another resource, but there aren't many. And I thought about the story and how I could expand it, and knowing, having my own experiences with what I've done to work through grief, and where my, and I wasn't a grief specialist or a grief therapist at all until after my son had died, and I was trying myself to figure out, what do I do now that this has happened to me, and trying so many things and anything I could do to help myself move through those feelings. And so the story, Brian's story, came to me, and I thought, well, you know, I could really do something with that story. And I pulled it out again, looked at it, and found that was these, I could break it down into bits. And so it reads like a poem, kind of, and when you break it apart, it sort of really fit nicely into these chapters where we expand on the topics that happen in the small story. And that's kind of how it happened, the book came to be. And then I looked around and found, and I had some books by Jessica Kingsley. Of course, they're a huge publisher of autism literature, and shopped it to them, and they liked it, and here it is. And I'm really happy about the way it turned out, and so proud of it. So I'm glad that it's helped you and that you have found it to be useful.
Very much so. You know, I'm, for our listeners out there who may not know, I'm on the autism spectrum, and I have two sons there as well. Death is not something that I've ever been comfortable dealing with myself, and your book, you
know. Well,
you're
not alone, so that's okay. There's a lot of people who are not comfortable in dealing with death.
Yeah, it's just having, you know, resources, workbook activities, different things that you have in your book that can help people work through things directly, I find to be just, you know, very helpful. And I was hoping that you could kind of get into, like, what's important to understand when helping children or teenagers or even adults with ASD who are grieving. What are kind of the differences that you might be thinking about in helping them versus perhaps somebody who might not be on the spectrum?
That's a really good question. And I know since you have the book, you've read the introduction, which I think is a really important part of that book, and I talk a lot about that specific thing. What I encourage people to do if they have a child that they've purchased the book for, that they read the book and work with the child along with them. And if you're grieving also, and I say there's a letter to the reader and there's also the introduction to the caregiver, whoever that may be, to get a journal, and you're welcome to write in the book as well, but to get a journal, have, you know, a log of your own experiences, and I recommend that for the parents as well. But one thing that I do say, all the people with autism or on the autism spectrum are going to experience grief in the same ways that anybody who's at that same developmental stage will experience it. The differences are unique to each person, of course, and everybody's grief, whether you're on the spectrum or not, is highly individual, and how we grieve is very unique to each person. There are a lot of things that we all share in the grief journey, but nonetheless, we're still alone in our grief, which is one of the things that makes it really difficult. Even people who are mourning the loss of the same person are experiencing it completely differently because they had their own relationship to that person. And so I think approaching it from that perspective is really important. And it sort of, to me, negates the fact of autism or not autism. Knowing that we all experience it completely uniquely is really important to understand. And then adding in the fact of an autism spectrum disorder, whether it's autism or whether it's Asperger's, whatever it is, knowing that that child or that adult or teen has certain unique differences about them that need to be paid attention to, and particularly for kids, they aren't always paying attention themselves to what's going on. And there's a list in the book of the things to really pay attention to, and I think one of those big things is sensory issues. I've never met a person on the spectrum who doesn't deal with sensory issues in to some degree or other. And what I discovered in my own life is, and I've heard this time and time again among neurotypical grieving people, they experience an increase in sensory perception issues. So I know it's happening with people on the spectrum. And I've heard from people on the spectrum in grief to also say they have new sensory problems that they didn't experience before. So that's always something to look out for. You know, however your child communicates best, knowing what their sensory issues are and paying attention to them, asking them about that, paying attention to how they're behaving, what's going on with them, you know, those things are really important. Also, for any grieving person, appetite changes, whether it's eating more, eating less. And so with kids on the spectrum or people on the spectrum, oftentimes it can be really difficult to pay attention to those body cues and watching how much food intake and making sure there's plenty of good nutrition and hydration is really important for this population. And then knowing that they may have different communication strategies or different communication modes is good, and you have to know them. Knowing your child is really important because you're the expert on your child. and to pay attention to what those differences are. Are they playing differently? Are they acting differently? What's going on? And then having a schedule, making sure that they have structure, that they can feel safe, is really important. Because again, for anybody in grief, grief is chaotic. It is one of the most chaotic periods of time that anybody will ever experience. When you're very close to a person, when your relationship to this person who has died has completely altered in that they're no longer present on this earth, it's so hard to figure out, what do I do now? And the way that we're impacted by grief physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, and every aspect of who we are as humans is affected by grief. And it's not predictable. And people on the spectrum don't like unpredictable things.
No.
Human beings don't like unpredictable things. So knowing that that is such a much more sensitive issue for people with autism and Asperger's, we have to be really sensitive to making sure that while we are aware that things are changing and things are in flux, what can we do to make sure they feel safe, that they have a structure, that they can expect this is going to be the same, this is going to be the same, because a lot of things are going to be different. And being aware of that is very crucial.
And would you say that it would be good to maybe track different emotions? You talk about journaling, and what can a parent do? You know, everything is so individual to that person. Are there things that you should be on the lookout for? You know, you talked about the eating changes, different types of things. What might be a warning sign where the person might actually need to have help beyond perhaps just working processes out at home, where they might actually need to see a therapist or a counselor or something along those lines?
Well, I think, again, that's really individual. Mm-hmm. If your child's not eating for, a long period of time, that's a problem, and, you'll want to talk to somebody about that if you're speaking specifically about nutrition intake and things like that. But knowing, what they're thinking, and again, in the book, there's a section about how do I know if we need to seek help. Honestly, most people who are grieving don't necessarily need to see a therapist. Grief is a normal part of life, and I try to really reiterate that over and over and over in the book, that when people we love die, we grieve, and that's normal. And death is a part of life. It's sad and it's painful, but it is a part of life. And when the people we love die, it hurts. And grief are the feelings that we have when we lose something that is precious to us. Everybody grieves. Mourning is the outward expression of those feelings. And I think it's really important that we mourn. And the book is about finding ways, your own way, that you can grieve and that you can mourn and express those feelings. And everybody does it in different ways. So that's what I'm hoping to achieve, that people can find, oh, this works for me, this doesn't work for me, this works for me. But back to the finding help, looking at, the checklist that's in here is I think really helpful, and it isn't that you necessarily need the book to have these things, but if you, for example, here's it says, my grief feels overwhelming most of the time, nearly every day, and you can check or circle what's true for you. If you have a young child, you can talk to them about that, or you can observe them to see how they're behaving. Is their behavior extremely different? Is it going on for long periods of time? And, a long period of time meaning maybe months. Because there's people will maybe argue this, but grief is normal and it happens and it changes our lives and it changes who we are. So, if your child's close personal relationship with a loved one has changed, then they're going to be affected and it's going to be longer than a couple of weeks.
Absolutely.
When we're talking about, like you were mentioning, Newtown, if we're not personally affected by that tragedy, we don't know those people personally, we're not involved, then 2 to 3 weeks, maybe a month of having behaviors that are not that person's norm, where they're continuing to have excessive anxiety and worry, eating patterns continue to be different, nightmares, then that's a concern. But if it's a family member of somebody who was killed, 2 weeks is no time at all. I mean, it doesn't mean don't find help, and especially in that situation, it's traumatic. That is traumatic grief. And that's not typical grief. So looking at the checklist, thinking about the grief or your feelings nearly all day, every day, much more times of anxiety, anger, or other painful and scary emotions than before the grief came, having problems concentrating more since the grief and it's causing problems at home, work, or school, experiencing major changes, and these are ongoing, in sleeping patterns or eating patterns, feeling like harming yourself, experiencing increased health problems for a long period of time. And then there's more specific questions about thoughts of harming self. And, you know, if those things are prominent, then you should seek help. But beyond those things, I mean, without those things in play, grief is normal, and you're going to have pain. You're going to have thoughts of the loved one. All those things are normal, and finding ways to express it are important. And because everybody's different, we have to find what way works for you. And that's really important. And part of that is a conversation, in whatever way you have conversations with your loved ones and your children. Does that make sense?
It really does. And I noticed that also in your book, in addition to the conversations, you have a lot of different creative activities as people express themselves differently. You know, you have different crafts, different art projects, different mm-hmm. things to kind of help them be able to get out those feelings. And I was hoping you could kind of give some examples of those, like the heart one and the body map and that kind of thing.
Oh, well, the heart thing you're talking about is one of my favorite ones. Well, I like both of those a lot. But in the book, I want to acknowledge and help people to realize that there are a lot of feelings that we can have in grief. It's not necessarily always just sadness, and it's okay to sometimes feel happy, to feel hopeful. There's also other things like worry and anxiety is a huge component of grief. I talk to people all the time who experience incredibly increased anxiety, people who never experienced anxiety. I'm talking about neurotypical people generally, and they don't know what to do because, oh my gosh, I'm having these panic attacks suddenly. And it isn't that, oh, don't worry about that. I mean, they need to be addressed, but most people don't know. This is kind of a normal part of grief. It's so common. And so finding out, are you feeling these things? What's going on? So we can all be aware, including you. We're normalizing those feelings by saying, you know, it's okay to talk about this. It's okay to express it. So in the What Color Is Your Heart activity, I ask people to really think about what they might be feeling inside right then in that moment. And are you feeling sadness? Are you feeling happiness at all? And are these things mixed up? And then take your crayons or paints or markers or whatever you choose to use and pick one up and think, well, this to me represents anger. This to me represents sadness. This represents worry. And then you make a little color key with your colors, so you'll remember what they are. And then you think about, how much am I feeling right now of happiness? How much anger? How much hopefulness or hopelessness? How much of that? And then the book invites you to draw your feelings into your heart, with each feeling taking up the amount of space that you think that it would inside your heart. You might have, you can do a pie chart, you can do swirls, you can do lines, you can do a graph, you could do a portrait, you could do however you want, but using your colors in a way that expresses how much of each of those feelings you're carrying right now in that moment. And I recommend doing it, maybe you could do it daily if you want, or weekly or whatever, and looking to see how your feelings change, so that it helps to know, well, it's normal for me to feel a different way at any given moment, because our feelings are changing so much, and it's okay to feel that way.
And I think having that validation, I mean, just knowing, having that, knowing that it's okay to feel that way, you know, it allows you to be able to accept your feelings more and say, okay, this hurts, but that's all right.
Yes.
You know, I'm angry, but that's all right.
Right. I mean, and it is okay. It is all right to feel those things. All feelings are okay. You know, it's then what we do with those feelings that really matters. And we can't control necessarily in grief how we're feeling, but to acknowledge them and to do something with them can help them move through us. And I don't even talk about healing anymore, because I learned from a good friend of mine that you only need to heal if you're broken or you're sick. And this is not, you're not broken or sick when you're in grief. That's normal to feel that way. It's more of a question to me of, how do I learn how to manage these feelings? How do I learn how to cope with this? How do I learn to let new experiences in, new love, new hope to come in, and still be able to remember this person I love and honor their life and honor our relationship together? And that's healthy grieving, when you can learn how to do that. And it's a balancing act, always, which can be hard when you're in chaos, which is what grief feels like oftentimes. And that's why, to me, for kids and teens and adults as well on the autism spectrum, it is very unpleasant for your world to feel chaotic. And
oh, absolutely. We want to have that control.
I know. Well, true. And it feels that way often anyway when things are going well. And so when something like death happens, then everything's turned upside down, and it just adds to the stress. And even that's another thing to bring up too, is everyday stressors, things that may already be stressful for your child or for you, can be magnified when you're in grief. So those things might be even bigger. But then you may have the opposite effect, where things that normally would be stressful kind of just don't seem to matter anymore. And again, it's watching your child's experience and noticing and observing, and then allowing them and yourself to have that space and the permission to express that.
Now, what changes, what kind of differences would you see developmentally in terms of how children display their grieving versus maybe teenagers? Trying to help, for example, maybe a 6-year-old versus a 13-year-old versus maybe an 18-year-old. Are there any different strategies that you would suggest that might differentiate based on age?
Well, generally, younger children, like you're saying, well, you know, 3-year-olds, they're going to know something's wrong. You know, 3 to 5-year-olds, they're going to know something's different, obviously, or even younger than that. They know. I mean, children, babies sense these things. And for them, making sure they have as much security, as much routine as possible, that they can feel safe, that they know they're taken care of, that they know that nothing bad's going to happen to them, keeping their world the same as much as possible. An older child, like school age, 5-year-old, 6-year-old, you may notice that they can have regressive behavior, meaning that they might act younger than they are, or they might show behaviors they have previously grown out of, like they might want more cuddling than they had been, or they might act like a baby, or, you know, say this goo goo gaga, or pretend that they're babies. And that's okay, because what they're communicating is that they need a little more security in whatever way works for them. I mean, I know not every kid on the spectrum necessarily likes to be hugged and cuddled, but what for your child is security for them? You might see more bedwetting in that age. They may be more fearful. They might have bad dreams. They may be afraid of the deaths of other people. You know, is that going to happen to you, Mommy, or is this going to happen to another person that they love? They may or may not bring it up. And for children that age, watching them is really important, because you don't want to bring up something that they're not afraid of. And we don't know what they're thinking. And if they don't tell us, we don't know. But
right.
You don't plant a seed of new worry. So that's where the observation of those children can come in. You don't know what they know. And so paying attention to what they're playing with, or how they're speaking, what they're drawing, how they're acting, really being careful to observe them. And that can be hard if you're in grief as well. So it can be helpful for, you know, extended family to sort of pay attention and bring support in. And for older children who do have a little bit of more concept of what death is, and maybe more of the permanence of death, they can then have self-blame, or they might think that their bad thoughts cause things like, oh, I wish you would just die. I mean, they might think that that caused that to happen, and they may or may not, again, tell you. And so it's this observation of paying attention. And as far as teenagers, I've never met a teenager yet, whether they're on the spectrum or not on the spectrum, that do not want to be treated like an adult. They want to be trusted. They want to be told the truth. And for any child, telling them the truth is crucial. And you don't, and I can't emphasize this enough, especially for kids on the spectrum. But I think for everybody, it's important to be really concrete and talk about death as death and use words like dead and dying, death, and not things like, oh, he passed on, or he passed away, or he's gone to his reward, or whatever, or God took him home. That's very confusing. And they might be thinking, well, you know, is he going to come back, or we lost him? He's lost. What does that mean? You know, they don't know what that means. You have to be really clear about it and use words that mean death and dying, and talk about things in concrete terms. And for kids, you know, older kids, give them the truth. You know, you don't have to give them details, but find out what they know. You know, ask them if they want to talk about it, and let them know that you're going to be honest and tell them, you know, I'm going to tell you the truth about what happened. So they know that they can go to you for the truth. And so if they hear other things from elsewhere, you know, rumors around school or from other members of the family, then they know that they can either dismiss that, or they can come back to you and say, hey, I heard this. What does that mean? So that they know that you, as their parent, they can trust in mm-hmm. the information that they're going to get. I think that's hugely important.
I agree with you, and it kind of brings up a, you know, obviously the subject from, you know, the Sandy Hook elementary school shootings. Mm-hmm. There's obviously, you know, it was a very sad, tragic event, and there are children, teenagers, adults from around the country, around the world that are grieving that and trying to make sense of something which, you know, is pretty much unfathomable. And yeah, I know that we both had agreed in advance that we would talk about it and it would be painful, but I think that we do need to kind of address this and how it might be affecting our children and teens and adults on the spectrum, because there are children and parents on the autism spectrum that are grieving from that tragedy, not just with personal loss, those who may have known some of the children there, but also they have extra anxiety and grief because the shooter, you know, there have been a lot of media reports that put autism and killer in the same sentence, and it's not healthy. It's causing a lot of stress, and people fear that the correlations of words are going to be inappropriately drawn. What do you have to say to those parents and those families on being able to help their children, or actually any adults that might be experiencing the anxiety as well?
Well, I think that it's a really important topic, and I just have to, I want to express myself, first of all, how it's just, there are no words for what happened. It doesn't make sense, like you said. There's no way to make sense of this, and it's very painful for a lot of people, and shocking and sad. And it's heartbreaking to think of, you know, that community and their families. And then when we had pulled into the mix this discussion about whether Adam Lanza is on the autism spectrum or not on the autism spectrum, for one, I think it's really important to recognize that there's been absolutely no confirmation that that's a fact, first of all. And even if it is, to know that violence is not a part of the autism spectrum. It's not related to Asperger's or autism. There may be people on the spectrum who engage in negative or aggressive behaviors toward themselves or others, but it is not specific to autism or Asperger's. It's not part of the diagnostic criteria for any autism spectrum disorder. That said, there are other things that can happen with people who are on the spectrum or who may have traits on the spectrum. They may have other mental illnesses. There may be other things going on, but even in that light, I've read and seen that his brother has said that Adam had a personality disorder. And again, all people with personality disorders are not murderers and mass killers. So this is very individual to him. I think, and this is a question and an issue for people on the autism spectrum, but also people with mental illness in general. Mentally ill people, the majority of them are very safe people who tend to spend more time being stigmatized and discriminated against rather than acting out against society. And it's a heartbreaking situation that we're all in, because the reason that's happening is because people are trying to find answers. You know, society is trying to find answers. The media is trying to find ratings, you know, whatever they're trying to do, and talk it up and make it more exciting and more, like it needs to be more exciting. It's really upsetting to so many people. And I would say to people, families on the spectrum who have children on the spectrum or who are on the spectrum, do you know your child? Yes, it's distressing, but we cannot control anybody outside of our own selves. We can't control what the media is doing. We can't control what the internet is doing and people on the internet. We can't control that. We will read things and hear things that are upsetting, and should we be upset? Perhaps. I mean, it is. It's upsetting to me as a clinician and as a person who has known hundreds of people on the spectrum. For years, I've worked with these people, and I've not seen one killer yet. I mean, I've seen some difficult children, and I've seen some difficult adults, but they're not killers. You know, I mean, it's not the same thing. And to remember that you know your child, and to reassure your child that they're loved, that they're cared for, that who they are is okay, I think is really important. And when you're dealing with the public, if it comes up, you know, it's your choice to decide whether you want to talk about this or you don't want to talk about this. But to know, you have the facts on your side. Violence is not a part of the autism spectrum disorder criteria for any one of them, for Asperger's, for autism, for pervasive developmental disability not otherwise specified, for Rett disorder, childhood disintegrative disorder, none of those. And when the DSM changes and it's all going to be under the encompassing umbrella of autism spectrum disorder, it still won't include it because it isn't part of the criteria for that condition. And it's not a mental illness. Additionally, it's a neurological difference. It's a difference in functioning in the world is what it means. And it doesn't mean that you're violent. And I think ensuring your children, letting them know that, that you know who they are, you know who at their core they are, is really helpful in mitigating some of that insecurity or that feeling of being discriminated against in any whatever way they may be feeling it. It's a really sad situation, and you know, I don't know what's going to happen with it. I don't know where it's going to go. I think it's really clear, and I've been heartened to see that when there have been interviews with quote unquote experts, and they are experts, but you know, psychologists or people who have experience in dealing with psychological disorders and or autism, and the media says, oh, well, didn't Adam Lanzam have this kind of disorder? And they have always said, we don't know that, and violence is not associated with Asperger's. They keep saying it. And so all I can hope is that this is what gets through.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you completely, and I truly appreciate you reiterating that with our audience, because we don't want people to be doubting themselves or doubting their children or, you know, experiencing extra anxiety on top of that which, you know, unfortunately is going to be normal in a situation like this. Mm-hmm. I just, you know, I appreciate you mentioning that. And there are a number of different, I know, autism organizations that have put out statements to that effect. And it will continue, you know, to be put out there. But for kids that, like, might be going to their middle schools or their high schools, and maybe their peers might know that they have Asperger's or autism, and they're suddenly, you know, starting to say, oh, well, my parents said I couldn't hang out with you anymore. Mm. What would you say, you know, in a situation like that here in the here and now, how can we help kids who might be, unfortunately, getting the negative repercussions from the initial media stories?
Well, I know, you know, and you know, that, you know, our kids on the spectrum tend to have a lot more problems with bullying in schools as it is,
yeah,
because they are different. They may seem different. They may talk about different things. They may behave differently. Socially, they may be different. You know, I'm not going to say awkward, and that's not necessarily true. It's they're all so different, but they do kind of stand out sometimes. And sometimes that's a good thing, and sometimes it's not a good thing. And in high school, particularly, and in middle school, that can be a really not good thing, and we see that all the time. So, again, I would say I think observation of your child and how they're behaving. Are you noticing differences? Do they seem more withdrawn than usual? Are they avoidant? Are they not wanting to talk about you? Do they seem talk to you? Do they seem sadder than normal? What's going on? I mean, you have to be, I think, very vigilant in noticing, because if you have a child that doesn't necessarily come home and tell you what's going on, you have to look for signs and then sort of open the door to allow them to be able to communicate about what's happening. And depending on, you know, what they know already and their level of sophistication and understanding of what's going on with the situation in Newtown and the media and all of the speculation about what that means for people on the spectrum, you can ask them, hey, you know, have you heard anything about what's going on? Have your friends said anything to you? You can ask them open-ended questions. You know, how is school going? Are you hearing about it at school? You know, are people talking about it? If you have a relationship with their teacher, and with teenagers, you have to be a little careful with this, because sometimes they're like, Mom, I don't want you talking to my teacher. You have to be careful, but you may want to talk to the teachers. What are they noticing? Are they seeing anything? And again, I think it's really important anyway, especially if you have younger children, to talk to the teachers and to the school. What are they doing at school to help support your child in their classroom or in the school in general? How are they addressing it? If it's a problem, you need to know, and keeping that communication line open. And then if you find out that they're struggling, if something's happening, you need to talk with the school people about this, the officials, your teacher, the principal, what's going on, to try to figure out what can we do as a support system for that child to make sure this doesn't happen. What can we do then to educate the classroom, the other students, about what's going on? If it isn't happening, we don't want to create that problem.
No.
So
no.
That observation is so important, and communication with your child and having a relationship with them where you can know how they're feeling about it is really important, I think. Is that helpful at all?
Oh, that is very helpful. I mean, I would imagine that our listeners out there are, you know, are very happy to be able to have this advice from you. And I also wanted to talk a little bit about empathy. That's something unfortunately, the media often says that those of us on the spectrum do not have it, or we lack it. It's not true. And we may just show it differently, or we may feel it too much. But I think it's important for people out there to have empathy, and for those that are on the spectrum, and to kind of get some words out there. Can you just talk a little bit about empathy and autism, and maybe empathy in this particular situation, on how individuals on the spectrum may show empathy, and how that might look a little bit different from those that might be neurotypical?
Well, you know, when you said just a second ago, sometimes we may feel it too much.
Yeah.
I think that that's often the case. You know, I've worked with people on the spectrum since 1996, and had never had any exposure to people on the spectrum. And I was just, it was amazing to me to meet these people. And I was one of those people where, when I started doing that work, just knew, oh, this is, I'm really good at this. I really click with this. I those people. And
yeah.
I just feel like it's part of what I do, which was an interesting kind of experience for me at that time. And I learned as much as I could about autism. And so at that time we had, a lot less resources and a lot less was known, and there were a lot fewer people on the spectrum actually. But everything I read was like, oh, they don't have empathy, they don't feel things this way or that way. And I could tell from the people I knew that was wrong. And there were so many things about the people I worked with that sort of totally flew in the face of everything I was reading. That, and especially in the population I was working with, they would come, they would have these diagnoses of autism or PDD-NOS or whatever, and then these IQs that were, you know, so low because they had such communication disorders. And I was like, this person is not profoundly mentally retarded. I can tell they're not. They problem solve. They can get what they need. They communicate in different ways, and they find out. And to me, I just thought that was, how could I, not having any experience, I was still in graduate school, I mean undergraduate school, I was an English major, had never had any experience. How could I be with these people and it's so clear to me that they obviously are intelligent, they obviously have empathy, we have a relationship with each other, why do other people not get this? I mean, it's still a mystery to me, I know, but it's just, now we know that people on the spectrum do have empathy, but often they may feel so overwhelmed by their emotions or sensory processing things are going on or both of those things at the same time that they are not expressing it the same way the neurotypical person might expect necessarily. That doesn't make it less than. And it's finding ways to know that about the person you love on the spectrum and helping them to understand you and you understanding them, and there's a communication issue. But in as far as empathy and children, empathy is a skill that's developed, you know, it takes a long time. Three-year-olds and four-year-olds and five-year-olds don't have empathy. They can say, oh, well, no, I wouldn't want to get hit or punched, but that doesn't mean they're not going to do it when they're mad. It's harder for them to put themselves in somebody else's position. Empathy is to imagine what it might feel like to be in the situation of another person and experience that, what it might be, and then let that inform how you interact with that person, how you talk to that person, how you feel towards that person. And a lot of people don't have empathy, and it's not because necessarily they're on the spectrum. It's not. They may have had trauma. They may have been abused. They may have had been neglected when they were children, and those people, or when they were young, and those people have a harder time with empathy, but they can also learn it. It can be learned. The more you're exposed to parents or teachers or therapists who are saying, hey, what do you think about this? What if this were you? What if this situation was this way? And we can work with our kids in that way. But I don't think the assumption needs to be that a kid on the spectrum doesn't have empathy. I don't know how much we need to try to tell them to have empathy with the families in Newtown, because to try to say, what do you think it would feel like to be in that situation? That's a little over the top. But,
yeah.
You know, I think
you don't want them to be.
You don't want, going down I don't line, think yeah. that's what you want to try to do, especially with a kid with autism. And I think, you know, I learned a long time ago when I was going to workshops and things that, and the way I sort of conceptualized it was, it's almost like they have superpowers. It's like super hearing and super visualization and super super everything. And so why would they not have super feelings?
Yeah.
They just aren't able to express them the same way that I might express them. And so you end up in overwhelm. And so if we try to, you know, push empathy for the families in Newtown on kids on the spectrum, that would be a mistake, I think. To say, yes, this happened, and let them then have a response is a different thing. But having empathy, I think the more important thing would be to have people not on the spectrum to try to have empathy for those who are. And what would it feel like? Can you imagine if you were a person who was diagnosed with autism or Asperger's and suddenly everybody's talking about how this mass shooter has the same disorder, and then they're correlating that? What do you think that must feel like? For other people to try to have empathy and not to make snap judgments. I don't think there's a problem with people on the spectrum having empathy. I think they have plenty of empathy. It's a question of everybody else around them figuring out how to communicate with them and helping them communicate it towards us.
I absolutely agree. I really do. And I think it's important that you say that, because I think a lot of us that are on this spectrum are kind of, you know, struggling. I mean, we want to be able to accept our feelings for what they are, and we want people to accept us for who we are and not be forcing us to be people that we're not because we don't conform to what their vision of what empathy might look like.
True.
I wanted to also, you know, and I kind of want to get away from that and get a little bit more back to your book, because in your book you talk about also, you know, positive ways, you know, to be able to celebrate and honor loved ones who have passed. And I want to be able to have you talk about those, because you've got some really neat ideas in there. And I want to make sure that we kind of, you know, have a chance for our readers, our listeners, I should say, out there who are listening in to be able to hear about some more of the great things that you suggest in your book to help people find their own way to grieve.
Oh, well, thanks. I mean, we talked about the what color is your heart, and there's several, you know, expressive activities that way that help people to express their feelings or express their experience. Because, again, I really want to reiterate that it is not just about feelings. And sometimes it's okay to not have a whole lot of overwhelming feelings. And grief manifests in a lot of ways. It can be physical. It can be mental and cognitive. It can be lots of different things, like in cognitive, I mean in our thought processes. I mean, you might be thinking about the person who has died a lot, but not necessarily having overwhelming feelings, and that's just as valid. There might be changes in your thought processes. You might have problems concentrating. You might lose things, and again, that's another issue with people on the spectrum. They tend to have a lot of executive functioning problems.
I was going to
right?
say
organization, track
yeah.
of things. You might find that that's going to be impacted because that happens with neurotypical people, and then they don't know what to do. They're like, I can't find my keys every day. I don't know what's going on. I can't remember my schedule. I can't, and that's it's normal. I mean, yes, it could be a problem, you know, for your job or at school, but it really is normal. And to know that that's a possibility of now what's the new normal can be comforting and validating, so you know you're not going crazy, because you're not. You're normal, even though you
and
might
I think,
not feel that way.
I think it's really important for people to understand that, because a lot of times those of us on the spectrum or those with kids who are on the spectrum, we feel kind of isolated. We feel that other people don't get us, and to have a sense of saying, okay, it's okay to feel this way. You're going to be going through this situation, or you may not, but even if you do, it's all right. And, you know, I think that that, you know, as you said, provides that sense of validation and that it's okay.
And it is okay. And, you know, when you were talking about ways of remembering those we love, there are a lot of things in the book that can spark ideas and help you to find your own thing. But a very important piece of grieving, I know, is ritual. And, you know, of course, the big ritual is the funeral. And again, with funerals and memorial services and things like this and whatever traditions that individual families go through, there's a chapter in the book where I talk about those things really in detail and what they mean and what they are and what happens. Because a lot of times, especially too with children, a lot of families say, well, we didn't want them to go to the funeral. That needs to be their decision. I really feel strongly about that. If the kid wants to go, they need to go. You need to have a plan so that if they become overwhelmed or they need to go, is there somebody else that can go out with them? You know, like, for example, if it's a close family member who's died and you as the mother may want to be present for that ritual, is there somebody else who could be identified ahead of time to say, you know, if he wants to leave during the time, I'll go with him and it's okay. And you talk about that and you have a plan ahead of time so that you know, but if they want to go, they should be able to go because they deserve to be able to do that. And in the book, I talk about in detail all these different things, and there's a glossary. There may be words that they haven't heard, but they're getting thrown around, memorial or cremation, and not knowing what that means. And with all children, and I've found this, again, it's that whole magnification of stuff with the kids on the spectrum. If they don't know and they're not told, they'll make stuff up. And usually what they imagine is far worse than the reality.
Mm-hmm.
And if we
Definitely.
Just tell them, then they know what these things mean. And so that part of the book goes into that. And if it's already happened, that's okay too, because then there's a section about what did your family do, what traditions did you guys have, what was that like for you, and helping them to express their experience. But then beyond the funeral or the memorial service or whatever the family chooses to do, it needs to not just end there. Because what ritual helps us do is to provide structure. And as I said before, grief is a time of chaos. It's just, it really truly is chaotic. You don't know how you're going to feel from one minute to the next, from one day to the next. You might feel happy, and then all of a sudden you might hear a song, or you might see a picture or have a thought, and then you feel differently. And it's very unpredictable. And what ritual helps us to do is to sort of provide a container in which we can put the chaos, and it helps to tone it down a little bit. It helps us to have some boundaries around that feeling of just flailing in space and not knowing what we're doing, which is what chaos is. And so when we can create rituals, and they can be very small things like lighting a candle every evening at dinner, or deciding every Friday night you're going to watch that person's favorite movie, or whatever the thing is, it can be very small, or it can be elaborate, like I'm going to make a shrine to this person. We're going to have their picture, and we're going to change the flowers every Sunday, and we're going to light a candle here, and I'm going to sit in front of that picture, and I'm going to think of them, and whatever you want to do. And there's lots and lots of ideas in there. And there's also a section about how other cultures remember and honor the ones they love who have died. And to me, it's sadly, our American culture and the Western culture in general does not do that. We're a very death-denying, death-fearing society who doesn't really want to think about that. We don't like to think about aging, much less dying. And so we don't deal with it until it's right on top of us and we have to deal with it. And then it's really difficult. But in other cultures, they spend time remembering the people they love who have died. The Mexican tradition of Day of the Dead, it's a huge celebration, and I love it. And there's conversation in the book about that. And in Japan, they have the Obon Festival, where they remember ancestors and those they love who have died. And so it's ideas based on other cultures' ways of dealing with grief and remembrance, and encouraging the children, the teenagers, the adults who read the book to try to incorporate some of those things and ideas for creating your own. There's crafts in there about Day of the Dead, the skeletons that are characteristic of that holiday that represent life and death being intertwined, because that's reality. And there's my favorite project in the book is the Japanese lanterns, and in the Obon Festival in Japan, to begin the festival or to send it off, they have these the lanterns that they put on the water that help the dead to see their way here and then to go back to the spirit world. And it's beautiful. And so that project is how to make a lantern that you can float if you want to. And in doing those things, you do them purposefully and mindfully to honor your own grief process and to honor the life of that person who has died, and to acknowledge that I still have a relationship with this person, and that's really important to maintain that connection. We don't have to say goodbye to them. Why would you do that? You don't have to say goodbye. Death ends a life, not a relationship, and we can continue to have that, and that is really healthy.
And I wish I could have you go into that even more. I just was looking, and I saw that we only have about a minute and a half left.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. It went by quickly. And what you said was so right on, so spot on. I want to be able to give you a chance in these last minute or two to be able to tell our listeners where they can find your book, how they can get in contact with you. And then if you're willing, I'd love to be able to have you, you know, come back on again in the new year, and maybe we could talk about this more in depth.
Oh, sure. I would love to come back. Yeah, I would love to come back. And the book is available, Finding Your Own Way to Grieve, a creative activity workbook for kids and teens on the autism spectrum. But you could, you know, you can just put Finding Your Own Way to Grieve into a search engine. It's on Amazon. It's on Barnes & Noble. It's also available from the publisher's website at Jessica Kingsley Publishers. It's jkp.com. And also, I was telling you, Karen, before we came on air, that I got an email today from the publisher. Initially, in the book, there was supposed to be a section letting the reader know that they could go to the resource page on jkp.com and have some downloadable sections from the book that they could print out if they need to. And it was omitted, unfortunately, but they sent me the link to it now, and the reprint, hopefully it'll be a reprint, that they'll have it in there. But it's still accessible now, and if the listeners want to check that out, they can go to www.jkp.com/catalog, and that's the British spelling with the catalogue/book/, and here's the long number, 978-184-905-9220/resources/.
And you know what? I'll go ahead and put that up on the autismempowerment.org site too.
Do. So. That'd be awesome. And when you click on that, you just go to download PDF, and it has the heart for color your heart. It doesn't have, unfortunately, it doesn't have the information preceding the, in the chapter information about that or the body exercise, but it does have checklists for how thinking about how I'm feeling and the checklist for would I need more help for me or my child. That's there. And also the very first chapter is the original short story that I wrote for Brian, and that's available there.
And I highly recommend that people check that out. It was very eloquently written. And I'm sorry, I wish I could talk longer, but we're kind of out of time here. You can also reach Carla directly at her website at www.carlahelbert.com. And Carla, I wanted to thank you so much, more than words can say, for taking the time to come on air today and express with our listeners about your book, Finding Your Own Way to Grieve, and talking about this subject that's important to us all.
Thank you, Karen. It's been so great to be here. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, and I will connect with you listeners out there. We would like to bring Carla back and perhaps in our next session have an opportunity for you to be able to call in with your questions. Feel free to send your questions to me in advance at Karen@autismempowerment.org, and I will keep you up to date on when we're going to have her scheduled. So thank you again, Carla, and to our listeners, this has been Karen Kreitcha with Autism Empowerment Radio. Thank you for your support of our station and our nonprofit organization, and thank you for listening in with Carla Helbert today. Have a great evening.